This episode of MATE was made possible thanks to Open Universities Australia, where you can now study single-module postgraduate units from leading Australian universities without having to enrol in a full university degree. To find out more, head to open.edu.au. This is MATE, a podcast about marketing, advertising, technology, and entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Adam Jaffrey, and I'm a digital strategist and entrepreneur. Before we get into today's episode, I want to just kind of make note on that word, entrepreneur. I've started a business. I haven't spoken much about it publicly yet, but I've been really hard working on this for the past couple of months. So stay tuned. I'll make some announcements shortly. But in the meantime, that's been keeping me really busy and I haven't had as much time to record new episodes of MATE as I'd like to. MATE's had some really great growth over the last, 9 months since the start of 2017. And there's a bunch of people listening right now who may not have heard some of the really awesome early episodes that we had. I've gone back through the archives to find some of my personal favourite episodes of MATE that I want to play for you. So we're going all the way back to July 2016 to episode number 6 of MATE to hear from Ryan McLeod. Now, Ryan is an iPhone app developer. He's built this really awesome game called Black Box. It's kind of confusing. It's pretty challenging. You kind of have to play it to understand. But essentially, you solve challenges in this game by doing anything except touching the screen. So there's things, you know, shaking the phone and playing volume and light and, you know, settings and all kinds of weird and interesting things that gets you to think outside the box. It's a really fascinating game, and we talk in this interview about some of the challenges of actually designing a game like that. We discuss, some of the ethical implications of just design in general, and I also pose the question to Ryan whether his game is good or evil. And stick around for the credits after the interview, because I've got a bit of an update, a year and a bit on from when we actually recorded this interview, and a lot's happened with the game and in Ryan's life. So until then, let's go talk to him. So who are you and what do you do?
I'm Ryan McLeod. I'm the designer and developer behind Black Box. I was calling myself a front-end engineer for a while. Now I'm calling myself a designer developer, I guess. My friend says I should be calling myself an interaction engineer. I don't really know how to describe my background anymore.
Interaction engineer, designer, developer, like, what are all those things mean?
A bunch of Twitter bios.
Because I think in isolation, they all make sense, right? You're a designer.
Yeah.
Or you're a developer. But what's a designer developer? Or what's an interaction engineer?
Yeah. I think all these titles have become so blurred. The reason for designer developer covered being a designer and also developing at the same time, but it doesn't really describe that much. Interaction engineer gets a bit more into really working on like the, you know, human-centric design of products and the interaction between people and the things that they're using, working on that, and not just designing and talking about it, but actually making it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something at the start there, Black Box.
Yeah.
What's Black Box?
Black Box is a really weird iPhone puzzle game. It's a collection of over 50 puzzles that are solved primarily without touching the screen. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with sensors or the operating system itself or astrological events or
So you play the game by not touching the screen. That's a really, really weird concept.
Yeah.
So what's an example of like how you might solve one of the challenges?
So one of the very first challenges you start off on is about the motion of your phone. And all of these kind of have like a really brightly colored visual that sort of gives you a sense of what's going on, but doesn't quite tell you exactly what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I like to describe it to people like, you attach like rattles to babies' wrists or their legs, they start to hear the sound and associate where their arms and legs are. It's kind of like that for the proprioception of what sensor is being used. So you use this first one, and this red level is moving around the screen like a liquid, and you figure out that it's about the orientations of the phone, or a little sun means the brightness of the screen. I don't want to give away too many, but
So it's
they get more obtuse.
Yeah, so there's kind of like a visual hint that gives you some clues on what you need to do, but then you've really got to rack your brain to figure out how to solve it.
Yeah, some of them are definitely designed to be, you look at it and you're not going to get it in one go. You need to put it down and come back to it, or you need to check it in a couple of days and see how it looks different or something.
Yeah, okay.
That's tough for people to adopt to. Yeah.
And so that's a really bizarre kind of game. I've not seen anything like that before. How did you come up with the inspiration behind that?
A lot of people ask that, and I've started to figure it out, but I hadn't thought about it for a while. I don't play that many video games, but the ones that I have really played and loved are like Portal, Fez. I don't know if you've played Machinarium. I just said Portal, right? All these games with like a lot of Easter eggs, a lot of puzzles to sort of solve. And Fez is one of the most beautiful ones because they spent years designing it. And one of the main goals is to collect these little cubes. And there's like 100 cubes that you collect. But then I don't think this is a huge spoiler at this point. There's actually like 200 cubes you can complete. You can get to 200% completion. So like half the game is literally Easter eggs. And I think Easter eggs are one of the most fun parts of games like that. So
yep.
I wanted to make something that just celebrated that. And when the iPhone first came out, people were talking so much about how it's this little box of sensors. And so you had all these people that before were making products that had their own screens, their own batteries and stuff like that. And suddenly started switching where like the iPhone, they could offload a lot of the work to the iPhone or use the, you know, magnometer on the cell phone or the rotation sensors or any of that. But then it's like it disappeared and no one did anything interesting. Especially like games. I mean, some apps try to do things like there was the Peek, the calendar app where you cover the top of the screen and it kind of changes the interface, or like you can shake to undo and stuff like that. But we don't really see people go into those areas much anymore, especially in games where you'd think people would want to the most. That's an area where you can really play around. And so I felt kind of frustrated that no one had done that, and I wanted to see a game like that. So I started working on it. Of course, I don't get to play Black Box now, but I get the joy of watching other people struggle through it.
So. You know all the answers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned a little while ago this idea of an Easter egg. Might be good just to explain, like, what is that?
Yeah. So an Easter egg, I guess, I would call like a non-essential part of the game. Some hidden thing that the developers put in there. I don't really know the history too much of Easter eggs, but usually it'd be like a wall that you could walk through and there was extra coins in the room. Or like in Mario, there's certain tunnels you can go down and things like that. But they've become a little extra signature that people will put on something, or like actual features themselves. A lot of apps now, you know, in the pull to refresh menu will like hide something weird, or I don't know if you've seen the Ookla cat in the speed test app.
No.
You pull the speed test thing down, there's this really ugly, creepy cat, and every time you pull it down, it says something different.
Yeah. So this is like a hidden thing that developers put in for fun.
Yeah. And in Black Box, it really drives people to play with the game in new ways. I mean, the challenges already do that, but you know, some of them involve how often you come back to the game, or like if how much you messed with the game itself. They're what I call meta challenges. Because the whole game is already Easter eggs, so.
So that every challenge is an Easter egg. But I was going to ask you about that. So you've got these things called meta challenges, which is it's an Easter egg within a game of Easter eggs. It's like an ultra level of Easter egg, right?
Super meta, yeah.
Which I guess is why you call them meta challenges. But they're really fucking hard. Yeah. The meta challenges. Like I got one or maybe two of them, and there's like a few I can see. Like if I tap the screen, there's a colored dot there.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Like literally no clue.
Yeah, I feel kind of bad.
Do you though?
I mean, there are thousands of people that find them, right? So I often think like I should make it a little easier or a little less obtuse, but then I have someone that sends me a screenshot of them digging around the source code of the website, you know? It's like, all right, like, you know, I had this developer menu that was hidden in the app for a while mm-hmm. that I would use or tell people to use to fix things. And then I had, you know, like a dozen people tweet me a picture of it. And I thought I hit it pretty well.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you put like a 500,000 monkeys in a room with typewriters, they hit everything.
So that actually brings up an interesting question. And this wasn't on the run sheet, but is Black Box good or bad?
Am I good or bad? Should be the question.
Is it good or evil? Because, like, yes, it's providing some level of entertainment, but there's also an immense amount of frustration that comes along with that.
Yeah. Well, that was a really fun thing while testing it is watching and listening to people. Cause there'd be people that would say, I hate this.
Mm-hmm.
This is like too hard, but then they're still playing 3 days later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they become one of the top players.
Yeah.
People that are complaining the most or seemingly complaining. So I don't think it's evil. I think it's definitely different and very, very frustrating, but people like the frustration. They like the challenge of it. And I don't think it's a bad thing. It helps people break boundaries and think more creatively, hopefully. I mean, people have done some crazy, crazy things. Watching their minds sort of open up. We have this like a room that we live in of like what apps can do and what we can do with apps. And this starts to like shatter all the windows one by one. Mm. So you have people sending in, I've had people send in photos of their iPhone in a bag attached to a vacuum. They're trying to solve a challenge that way. I won't say which challenge they thought that was helping solve. I thought that was crazy. But then a couple weeks later, another guy, different person, told me their story about putting their phone in a bag and attaching it to a vacuum.
I want to know what challenge this is now.
Yeah. Well, there's another guy that he's been talking about buying a weather balloon, but he hasn't tried it yet. I don't know. Maybe I am evil.
Yeah, but it sounds like you get a little bit of joy from it too. So,
yeah.
So you kind of talked about like why you wanted to create this game. What's some of the inspiration behind it, though? I know I was reading an interview. You talked about a few other kind of apps that have scratched the surface of this kind of style.
Yeah, there was one that sticks out the most was the Inception app,
mm-hmm. based on the movie, right?
Yeah. It was a promotional app made after the movie, and you would put on headphones, and it would distort the sound around you in weird ways. So you could enter different dreams, and they distorted the sound differently. But some of them were unlocked by opening the app really late at night. It would tell you that, you know, or like going to Africa was one of them, mm-hmm. opening the app in Africa, just these insane things. And I don't know. I thought that was really cool. And then I remember another time using Clear, which is a to-do list app, really beautiful to-do list app. And I opened it late at night one time. It unlocked like a secret night owl theme, mm-hmm. you know, then I followed some of the developers through the app on Twitter, and it gave me like the socialite theme.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was really fun, but nothing was fully formed as an idea yet. And then the same guys that made Clear worked on an app called Hatch,
mm-hmm.
which is a little personal like Tamagotchi for your iPhone. Yeah. And it would do things, you know, it'd be happy when the phone was charged, or it would fall asleep when your phone was dying, or mm-hmm. it would dance if there was music playing. And I think the idea kind of came around then. And I added it to my like big idea list. It's like quote unquote black box app. And at that point in time, it was just going to be a giant grid of colored dots, and they would all be going at the same time, and there was no visuals to help you.
I think you are really evil.
So it obviously changed, but they were just going to turn on, and you wouldn't exactly know what happened. And yeah, it's gotten a lot better.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's sort of how the idea more or less formed. And then it's been a constantly changing thing through development.
Yep. I wanted to ask you about kind of the implications of this game. I work in marketing strategy, and I was telling a few people in my team about this and how Black Box is actually a really good game for lateral thinking to kind of really expand, you know, how you approach a problem. I mean, that's what we do. We always have to think about, like, what problem are we trying to solve and how do we actually solve it? In you know, interesting and different ways as well, because it's not always, you know, a client wants to do some sort of marketing campaign or something. It's not always clear what we're trying to achieve. So have you had any kind of feedback from users, or was there any thought put into what implications Black Box has for just as a problem solving technique?
Oh man. I don't think directly there was like, you know, oh, I'm going to put in this one because it helps you expand your thinking in this way. That was definitely more of an afterthought.
Where does the name Black Box come from?
Black Box is kind of comes from the concept of you have some mysterious device and you don't know the internal functions of it. So it's used a lot in engineering where you talk about a problem where something goes in and something comes out changed and you don't really know how. It's a black box. So it's opaque. You can't see into it. Mm-hmm. You can't see the inner workings and the mechanics. So this, you turn your phone or yell at it and you get some sort of visual feedback. You don't really know what's going on and you have to mentally build up a model of what's going on inside the black box to solve it or understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sounds cool. So
it does. Yeah. So it's a really, really interesting game. I'm actually curious, how do you come up with new levels?
Yeah. So I think that's one thing where having really, really restrictive constraints is really liberating. So I have these insane constraints of like, you should be able to solve it by not touching the screen. And then on top of that, the visual, I kind of have like a personal rule that the visual should never be cartoonish or too iconographic. It should always be something where you could like take a screenshot of it and use it as a wallpaper. Like it's artful. But as far as the mechanics, it's just a lot of the iOS APIs, how you can interact with the device, just realizing like, oh, you know, that is something that you can do with anything on the phone where you can interact with it in some way or change the state of something can be turned into a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly, a lot of them come to me on runs, but I've had a long list. There isn't really a process. They just come up. The hardest part is coming up with the visuals.
Yeah. I can imagine, like, cause you want it to feel, interesting and enticing, but also hint at how to solve it, but not give too much away.
Yeah.
And also keep consistency across, the whole game as well. Cause there's a kind of a visual style that you have.
Yeah, there's definitely a certain feel. There was a point in time when I had this really cool, like, green slime sort of liquid thing for one of the challenges. And it was really cool, but it just didn't fit at all.
Yep.
The visuals, though, yeah, it has to put someone right on the edge of solving it without giving it away. And it's a really, really tough balance. And since everything is so clean and simple, there's, like, a lot hinges on the animation or just how things move to present sort of joy when it is solved.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of stuff looks really simple, like, oh, it's just circles, but it can take a lot of time to really get to a point where it feels right.
Mm-hmm. What's the hardest challenge you've got in the game?
Ooh. Well, I don't want to spoil it. I've got a favorite challenge.
All right, maybe we'll do that one.
Have you seen the biometric one? The touch challenge?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you solved that one?
Yes, that frustrated the hell out of me.
That's my favorite challenge.
Why is it your favorite?
Oh, it's directly inspired from a puzzle in the game, Machinarium,
mm-hmm.
by the Armantia studio guys. There's this puzzle where it's just so clear you're being asked these questions and you're answering them correctly and it's not doing you any good.
Mm-hmm.
And that breakthrough moment of figuring out what you actually have to do, I think is really cool. As far as...
And it's so simple once you know. I was just like...
Yeah. Well, it's funny too, because like if you know what what as a developer you're capable of doing with that. You know, people think I like know what their fingerprint is. Mm-hmm. They ask me like, oh, do I need your fingerprint? It's like, do you really expect me to launch something worldwide that would require my fingerprint? It's just people have my fingerprint up on the web. You can print it out and put it on scotch tape. Yeah. I guess hardest is probably the three vertical blue ones, the ones where I get messages from people and it's like, Ryan, I'm in a car on a mountain late at night. My husband is texting me wondering where I left with the car so late. It's raining hard and I don't know why I'm here to turn on one blue box.
The three vertical blue ones. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I know the ones you're talking about. That's not the hardest for me, though, but maybe we can discuss off air.
Probably one of the very few.
Yeah. I wanted to ask kind of about the performance of the game as well. Have you got any analytics on, you know, how long people are playing, how many challenges they're solving? Do you have that kind of stuff installed in the background of the app?
Yeah, there's a good amount of analytics that I've put in. It's like, honestly, probably too much for me to understand without someone who can just work on that.
Sure.
But I find analytics extremely interesting. Mm. I've got some numbers. There's been at least 300 years spent in challenges, just a couple human lives, I guess. I feel kind of bad about that. But then again, you know, there's other games that are much bigger waste of time, in my opinion.
Yes.
What other numbers are interesting? I'm tracking, you know, when you touch the screen and it sends a ripple across. Mm-hmm. I call those like home light jiggles.
Uh-huh.
There's people that do that like hundreds of times.
I do it a lot because I'm like, I can see there's more stuff there, but I can't get it. How do I?
Yeah. So there's things too, like when you, there's a reward for doing that a small amount of times,
mm-hmm.
but then you get this idea, you put this idea in people's head that maybe if I do it 1,000 times, there's some gold at the end of the rainbow or something.
Is there?
The number of people, I don't know. The number of people that have deleted the app and reinstalled it thinking that was a challenge. I'm adding a warning now to say, please don't do that. Like, how many apps have to worry about that as a problem?
Yeah, that is a very strange problem to have to solve. I guess, like, is that good for your iTunes ranking if people are installing the app?
I think that's a bad thing.
I don't know. It depends if iTunes factors in the delete as a bad thing, because no one knows what their algorithm is, right? But new downloads is obviously good, and ratings are good. They're probably the two main things. So,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it is good. Maybe you should make that into a challenge. Or is that not a good thing?
You know, yeah, I don't want to encourage that sort of thing. I'm pretty, I feel like I was tiptoeing already around things Apple might not be stoked on. So yeah, I mean, the app drives people to basically stress test it for me too. So there was a point when it was crashing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are just like, oh, what if I, you know, run music and switch music really fast and plug in headphones while I'm shaking it, you know?
Yeah.
Totally overwhelm the app.
Yeah. There is, speaking of shaking, there is, it is nice that you put in a few kind of visual cues, like, this challenge does not require you to shake the phone violently, but like, thanks for trying or something.
solid idea. Yeah.
So like, it's kind of nice. And I think that kind of comes back to your interaction engineer, style, that, you're kind of giving people a bit of nice feedback about something, even though it's not right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been a really interesting part of it, because the visuals are so bare that you latch onto any little change, right? Yeah. So there's been times where I've wanted to add things that make the visuals more interesting or compelling or whatever, but you add something that's just frivolous and people start assigning meaning to it. You know, there's people that write to me and they think they see things that don't exist. Mm. You know, like they revisit it and the color of something changed. It's like, it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
So you have to be really careful with what you say. But
I suppose you have to solve a lot of very interesting design problems with this. It's actually quite a technical app from maybe a development point of view. You have to know how to tap into different parts of the OS. But also from, yeah, like a design point of view, you... Because design is obviously not just the look of something. And I think a lot of people just associate design as, you know, you design logos or you design websites or whatever. But like interaction design or interface design or experience design, those are all like really important parts, particularly of digital technology and things like apps. The way something jiggles when you touch it, the way something animates, all that kind of stuff, right? So you've done a lot of thinking about that. What are some of the other really interesting challenges you've had to solve with Black Box?
A lot of it, I think, has been understanding what is important for me to spend time on. There's a lot of people that told me to ship it months earlier than I did. And I'm really glad I went through and polished the little things I did. They're the sort of things that you never would be able to put your finger on and notice, but they lead to the overall feeling people have about the game. Not sure. Your question specifically was more what's been tough engineering-wise?
Well, more so from a design perspective. Like, you were talking before about how you've had to be really careful about the things that you include or the things that you don't include. You talked about, you know, adding something into the app about, you know, don't delete it and reinstall it. Like, those are things that most developers don't have to put into their games, their apps, their software.
Yeah.
And purely just because this is a very unique and very strange concept, this whole game, you've got all these really weird scenarios that you have to think about.
Yeah, I mean, the whole game is edge cases, and if you're familiar, yeah, edge case of just like you have the normal way people use things, and then there's the fringe sort of stuff, and this is all operating on the fringe for the most part. Which makes testing it really tough. A lot of times I can't even automate the testing. You know, I just have to rely on a checklist of things to go through. But really it was about listening to beta testers, setting up, I had that chat set up in the app for beta testers. So there's this immediate feedback loop of like, you know, I read this hint and I interpreted it this way and did this. And it's just like, whoa, like I would have never thought of doing that, or that could be interpreted that way, or so I don't think it was so much like a technical challenge. I mean, obviously it was hard to make all those things, but really listening to people and like putting my ego aside too, and realizing when like someone says that this is how they interpret it and how they did it, it's like that's going to be a lot more people. That's not an off case sort of thing, and listening to everything.
Yeah. Okay. Last question about Black Box, and then we're going to kind of shift gears a little bit. But I just wanted to ask, what's the future of the game? Where are you taking it next?
Yeah, I've left the edges ragged on purpose.
You're referring to on the grid, there's, you know, these colored dots, and it's not a nice clean edge. They're going in. It's almost like a spider web sort of. It's all going off in different directions.
Yeah. It's a weird Tetris conglomerate.
Yeah, so that's intentional.
Right now there's 55 challenges, and
I'm gonna go count my dots right after we finish this.
You can check on Game Center. I have two more coming out very soon, probably another pack of 7 or 8 coming out after that. I have at least 24 more ideas for challenges, and more just keep coming. It takes a lot of time. It's tough to make them, but I'd like to keep making more challenges as long as I can. It's been a really fun way for me to sort of learn iOS and support myself. So
yeah, okay. So that, nice segue, by the way. I was going to ask. So what's it? So you develop a Black Box alone by yourself. Independent developer, independent designer or designer developer or interaction engineer. What's that like? How do you do that?
Yeah. It's tough, but it's not impossible. It's really hard to not have someone to look to make decisions for you. Not that that's something that I was necessarily used to, but it's just, I don't have a lot of people to bounce ideas off of. A lot of times it's like, okay, what color is this going to be? Like, sounds like an easy thing, but I'll agonize over that for a day.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's a meandering path. I've never really had strict deadlines or like a really good system set up for getting through to-dos. It's just, these are the things that need to happen next. And then, oh, I discovered I want to do this, which can be really tough in software because you get really quagmired in like gold polishing and adding a bunch of features, feature creep. Mm-hmm. But I sort of just chased a lot of that stuff until a point where I needed to launch it.
This episode of Mate was made possible thanks to Open Universities Australia. With Open Unis, you now have the flexibility of studying single-module postgraduate units from leading Australian universities without having to enrol in an entire degree. So this is perfect if you're a busy professional. You don't have to go to night school or anything like that. This is a brand new initiative that Open Unis has created, which allows you to upskill for your current role or maybe take the first steps towards a new one. And they have a really broad range of subjects that you can learn about. Things like technology essentials for managers or financial decision making. Or perhaps if you just want to learn something new, maybe you could study cyber terrorism and information warfare or democracy and dictatorship. There's over 100 units to choose from on topics from business to economics, technology, media to law. There's so many more. So instead of going to night school, why not work in a way that's flexible for you? You can work in your own time and learn about some really fascinating topics. To find out more about how to study a single unit from a leading Australian university with Open Universities Australia, head to open.edu.au. And thank you very much to Open Unis for your support of MATE.
Maybe let's rewind a couple of years, and I wanted to explore how you got to where you are. From what we've kind of been talking about, it doesn't sound like you have a design background or a development background. Let's kind of rewind a bit and figure out where this all started.
Sure. So in elementary school, I was always the computer guy.
Mm-hmm.
Got, you know, called to fix stuff. So I guess we didn't have an IT person.
So you were fixing stuff at school, like the school office computers and stuff.
Well, there was a time like I was in class and someone called the teacher and said they were looking for the computer guy. And I was like, I don't know who. And they're like, they're talking about you. Like, it's like I'm third grade.
You like go into the principal's
like, go fix the printer, office. Ryan. Yeah.
Right. Awesome.
Yeah. I don't know. I was interested in design. I was interested in robotics, a bunch of things. But when I applied to schools, it was, you know, check the box for like computer engineering or software engineering. And people, you know, said, oh, you're good at computers, apply for those things. And then when I got into Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, it's a town in between LA and San Francisco. You choose your major before you get there. And so it was like, oh, what did I choose? I chose computer science. All right. That's what I'm doing for the next 4 years. And that did really get like a solid background in software engineering for me.
Mm-hmm.
But like literally a week or two ago, I realized that I have almost zero passion for computer science as like a field, which like led to a lot of my angst going through school. I think, you know, I didn't want to work on these low level foundational things a lot of times. And I'm really thankful that I did learn them now, but it was because I wanted to work on websites. I wanted to be a front-end engineer. I wanted to learn design and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there weren't any classes for that. So it was something that I started working on the side, making personal sites and subscribing to design newsletters like Sidebar and just ingesting as much content as I could daily and practicing things during class. And sort of realizing like so many people that I would talk to were in these formal design backgrounds, and realizing that really isn't necessary if you're willing to put in the time and the patience. Like it takes years, but I think I had a kind of an eye of like things that I liked, and I slowly discovered, okay, like why do I like that? Okay, it's because this mechanic can I replicate that? And then like reading about, oh, that's the term for that. And it's just something that develops over time.
Yep. So computer science, just to kind of explain this a bit more, is that like the like backend engineering and kind of like servers and like architecture of like that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Computer science is like a old term from when computer science was much more about math, right? Now computer science is more the backend side of things. So it's about the algorithms, it's about speed, complexity, and it's not so much about learning a bunch of different programming languages. It's about, you know, getting really deep into one and really understanding how computers work on the software side of things. And I think the general attitude is with like a computer science degree, you generally go out and work in software, but you have this solid base and you learn those things that go on top. It's like, we're not learning how to build websites or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's more the software engineering side of things.
Right. So computer science is more the back end and software engineering is more the front end side of it.
Yeah, they overlap. And then you have computer engineering, which gets into a little bit more electrical and hardware.
Yeah. Okay. So you studied computer science, but you were really more interested in front end engineering and, well, front end development and front end design.
Yeah.
Because that kind of taps into what you said at the start, this interaction engineer, like how things look and feel and how you can kind of, you can conceive it, but also build it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really cool thing to be able to do. I think I realized early on, I really like consumer facing products. You know, developer tools are really cool and I'm happy there's people that are stoked to work on them or design CPU architectures and make them faster. But for me, it's like, I like being close to the actual thing that people are using. So, but having that as a base and then learning design and then sort of, you know, entrepreneurship is something we pick up and watch. Marketing is something you can pick up and watch. And now you've assembled a skill set for making stuff.
Mm-hmm. So what else do you want to solve then? what other problems are on the horizon that you think are broken and want to fix?
Yeah. Like we were talking about before, I'm really interested in interfaces, not just digital, but, you know, kitchen tools and road signs and stuff like that. It's just, how do we interact with our tools? And so often you can make people's lives better or actually save lives genuinely by like how something is designed. I'd really like to work on things that can make the world a better, more empathetic place and all that, which sounds really out there, but I feel like so much of work these days is, you know, making a product to pitch people to buy that they may not necessarily need and stuff like that.
Hmm.
There's so much other good that we can do with those sorts of fields.
The developer of the most frustrating game in existence, the evil developer Ryan, wants to make his next project about empathy and making the world a better place.
I'm learning.
I just thought I'd point that out there. When you were telling me about, like, you know, the design of everyday things, road signs, kitchen tools and stuff, that really struck a chord with me. I think I wrote back via email. I was like, fuck yes, this is, like, awesome. I get really frustrated about things in the world that are just really poorly designed. There's a traffic intersection right near where I work where there's kind of like this light rail or what we call trams. I don't know if you have trams in... in California, but it's like a light rail where there's like a pedestrian crossing as well as a motor vehicle crossing, all kind of overlapping. And as a pedestrian, you can only go like this kind of really long and difficult way to get to where you want. And everyone, like basically everyone, just jaywalks across the road to get to this other part. And I always say the UX of this intersection is horrendous. The user experience of this, like,
oh my god, yeah.
There are people like. We are users of that thing. There is an experience you have with it, and we take the shortcut because the way that some idiot designed it has done a really crappy job.
Yeah, I think so much of this, it's like saying things could be designed better. It like sounds really pretentious, but it's not. It's about being empathetic towards other human beings. Like if you design something in a way where you care about other people and you don't just go like, eh, it's good enough. Like that could hurt someone, or it can waste a lot of precious time or anything like that. And another way I like to think about it is like being a good host, something quality they talk about as a, I think, core value at Airbnb. And like, if you imagine you're hosting someone, you're like trying to think of what their needs are before they're at that point where they need them. And being empathetic to where things could go wrong is often a way to make something a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
That's going back to your earlier question about black box. Like, a lot of the times how I'm thinking is like, what sort of pit holes can people fall in? Where are people going to get stuck wasting a lot of time, or where are people going to get confused? And if, as you buff off all those rough edges and those really sharp crags, you end up with something that's well-designed, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that point about good design is really about empathy. I think that's a really good takeaway, and not one that I've thought of before. One thing that's really been frustrating me lately is doors that are really badly designed. I don't know whether to push the door or to pull the door, right?
There see is that verge thing?
Yeah. What was it? Some video by Vox, right?
Yeah, or Vox, yeah.
Well, Vox is the master company of Verge anyway, but I'll see if I can find that video. There's a name for this type of door. I can't remember what it is in the moment right now, but I'll pop the video in the show notes. Doors that are designed poorly, it's just so frustrating, like that, and whether something's push or pull, and the added kind of frustration is, yes, we do put a sign on that says push or pull, but both words are four letters and start with P. So, like, at a glance, I still don't know. And the amount of times that you see people, like, trying to move, it's like, no, man, it's a pull or a push. But, like, that's just bad design.
Yeah.
Why should it be difficult for the user of that to not know what to do, right?
Yeah.
The person who created it should have thought of a better way for people to engage with it.
That's something that people really need to remember is, I mean, I don't want to put designers in this like giant hero's role, but it's like, if you design something, a lot of times, if it becomes the standard, you should be assuming every time you make something, it's not like, you know, it's good enough, I'm out of time, or like, I haven't really tested it enough. Like, this could become the go-to way that things are made for 100 years, and it's hard to change.
Mm-hmm.
So getting it right off the bat is huge. I mean, with the doors, it's like, yeah, maybe there's some broken doors, but I saw an interesting one about toilets recently, toilets with dual flush.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, what icon is clear? Mm-hmm. If you have like, there's somewhere I had like a box and it's half shaded, and it's like, okay, which half is shaded? Is that half water or double the water? Or is three drops and one drop? And
yeah.
You know, or they have the circle with like 2/3 of it cut out, and
and
then you're leading to a lot of wasted water, and
definitely. And when you start to think about it, like, there's a lot of things in the world that are just, you know, could be designed better or just haven't really been well thought about, or there's a lot of things that have been well designed as well that you just don't think about. You just kind of go through your day and go, You know, you just have a great interaction. I mean, I guess the thing is, if something is well designed, you don't think about the design of it. You just use the product or the experience or the thing. So it
becomes an invisible extension.
Yeah. Yep.
It's not so much a tool, but yeah.
I was going to ask about how you find designing without a design background.
Yeah. So, like I was saying before, I kind of think of it the way, what do they say in Ratatouille? Like, anyone can cook.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, getting over the fact that you don't need this special background. People aren't necessarily born these things. If you have an eye, there's things that you like and things that you don't like, you can continue to refine that and understand it and become a designer. Like, getting over that it's not this crazy special thing, not to downplay any work that anyone's put into learning these things, but it's not a magical art. You can apply sort of engineering principles to it. Not to say that's what I do, but, you know, breaking things down to look at where people are getting stuck, or, you know, understanding why does this not feel right. There are a lot of intuitions that have to be built up. For a long time, I felt like I couldn't talk with designers, or I couldn't hold myself up in conversation or have the chops, because I didn't know the language of the things that I sort of felt. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that just took a lot of reading and understanding and, you know, taking in as many viewpoints as possible to be like, oh, you know, this feels good because it has a good vertical cadence, or the white space is comfortable. And it's something that I think can be acquired. It just takes some determination to want to have it. Mm-hmm. I think I have a tough time talking about it because I don't have a formal background with it. So it's a very mushy, internalized thing. It's not like the computer science. I've been trained in a very linear way.
Yeah.
But this is sort of this ball of skills.
Look, I think you answered my question in a roundabout way, because it seems like you kind of don't feel super comfortable talking about it because you don't have the background, but like you kind of feel it, right?
Yeah.
You kind of know when something's not right, and you can problem solve your way. And maybe you can kind of use some of those engineering skills to kind of get to like the mindset, I suppose, to try and figure out what the issue is that you're feeling. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. The last thing I wanted to kind of talk about today, Ryan, is what does the future hold for you, and what do you see yourself doing next?
I definitely don't want to be making games forever. This has been like a really great way to learn, and I want to keep working on it, but I definitely need to do something more meaningful in the end. I'd like I was saying before, I'd like to work on something that genuinely improves people's lives. I'm not sure Black Box is doing that right now.
Depends how you look at it.
Yeah. I'm not totally sure. It's when I got out of school, I knew I wanted to not work at a normal job, as if I could make it happen. And so I'm going to continue to try to hold on to that if I can. But I'm getting to a point where it would be nice to work with a team, because it's hard to really accomplish anything big by yourself. So I'm keeping an eye on the horizon, mm-hmm. but not completely sure.
So you're not sure what it is, but it's something.
Interaction engineering.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of that, the last question I always ask is what is exciting you right now?
Yeah, I think I wanted to flip it around to what not excited about right now, which is chatbots.
So you're not excited about chatbots?
No, I mean, yes and no. It's just kind of, it's driving me crazy how excited everyone's getting. Mm-hmm. It's just, you can't go anywhere without seeing articles about it and some new pull apart of how chatbots should work or service. It just reminds me a lot of when, like, you know, the corner smoothie store wanted an iPhone app, or like all these restaurants wanted iPhone apps. And it's like, am I missing something, or is there some value here? Mm-hmm. And then like, a couple of years later, Pinterest came out and everyone started copying that UI. And it's like, that very spread out scrapboardy thing is great for like fractally discovering things when you're in a mode of exploration, but it's not a way to lay out a blog. It's mm-hmm. like chatbots. It's kind of a lot of times a lazy interface to something. It's like a more scalable way to do something. It's a phone tree when you call and have to deal with an automated assistant, and you're like smashing zero to talk to a real person. I guess I'm just not convinced that it's the solution to most of these problems. Mm-hmm. But that said, I do really like some of the conversational interfaces. Like my roommate has a Amazon Echo, and that's really nice to talk to. But I don't think when I'm on REI's website, I want to be asking a robot about backpacks. Mm. I think there's a better way to do that.
You should have a listen to, recorded an episode a couple of days ago with Sol Flores. And he kind of mirrored a similar kind of attitude towards some of these things that are just really overhyped at the moment, you know, robotics, or just, you know, people, and especially people in my industry, in advertising and marketing, people are like, oh yeah, this is the next big thing. It's going to change the world. And then it kind of doesn't. So, like, you know, a couple of years ago, it was the Internet of Things, and then, you know, big data. And then there was, like, this year, it's probably VR and chatbots are the two big things. Probably because that those are the two things that Facebook announced at their F8 conference recently. So, like, but, like, is it going to make a meaningful difference to anybody's lives in the near term? You know what I actually think, and again, just to reference the last episode with Sol, we talk about innovation a little bit and how innovation is not this kind of just one moment where everything changes. It's a progressive and iterative process, and it's not just like one person. It's kind of a group of people, and there's an organizational design that can produce innovation. I guess that the takeaway is that you don't end up ever, like these things, they don't just like come along and change the world the next day. So chatbots, wow, this is the newest thing. It's going to change the world tomorrow. And VR, it's going to like, that's just not how it works. It's going to be iterative, and in hindsight, we'll look back and go, oh, wow, like, I remember when we didn't have mobile phones or the internet, you had to dial up and you couldn't be on the phone at the same time as the internet. But it wasn't just one day that it was like, oh, cool, like, everything's different now.
I think it's what you see a lot is, like, this super explosive growth where maybe it's a good thing that there's so much attention to it and all these companies get funded and people explore the technological boundaries of these things. But then, you know, within a couple of years, a lot of those branches that didn't go anywhere die off. And we end up like farther down the road on a lot of those technologies. And they do come into use, but definitely not as hyped as like Amazon's delivery drones and stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah, definitely.
But VR is wicked.
So you are excited about VR?
I am excited about VR. I don't think it's like 3D TV. I mean, I just tried it on for the first time recently, and I told you I got to try the Vive in room scale, which was just, I genuinely got lost in it for a couple moments, and just it changes the game in so many ways. It's weird. Like, it's hard to imagine a bunch of 12-year-olds at home with them on, or like, you know, a family at home strapping them on their faces and leaning back on the couch or whatever, but it's impossible to say. I think that it's not going to have meaningful impact. I mean, the AR that comes from it and whatever this other Magic Leap lens thing, what that does could be a little more altering of our future than strapping a giant box on your face, but it's exciting stuff. I felt like a kid at Disneyland. It was,
yeah, so I actually spoke to Ethan in episode 2, and we talked about VR, and one of the really interesting things that we kind of, well, uncovered through that discussion was that virtual reality is a way to experience human empathy. You can put yourself in someone else's shoes or in another situation. So, you know, we were talking earlier in this discussion about empathy, and I think that's maybe some of what is exciting you about that. There is kind of this weird tension, though, from a design perspective with virtual reality. Like, there's this kind of empathetic side to it, and you're able to really immerse yourself in something and actually feel a situation. But so when you're looking through the glasses, you feel that situation. But the process of that beforehand, strapping on a massive piece of glass and goggles to your face, is not very approachable and not very empathetic from a design perspective. Like, the actual product itself is kind of shit, but the experience you get from it is pretty amazing. So this is weird tension.
I guess that's what I was trying to get at. Is like, I know this is not the end of this line.
Mm.
But you can feel 100% what we're capable of and where we're going when you try it on. And that's really, really a trip. I think another thing was with the empathy of it. Before I had tried it on, I was a little creeped out that, like, you're going to have these shooters, and now it's like you're really training to shoot someone or run around a corner and peek out, stuff like that. And it's, you know, all the mom's arguments against Grand Theft Auto and stuff suddenly seem a little more real. But then when I tried it on, it was like, okay, where are all the shooting games? And there really aren't that many.
Mm.
And my friend put it as, like, there aren't that many because people discovered it's really uncomfortable and it's really unnerving. I even tried one game that was super cartoonish. It's called like Rough Cuts, and there's these really blocky robots, and you have throwing knives and they have guns, which is unfair, but you know, they turn towards you. They turn towards you and like point a gun at you. And before they've done that, it's fine. I'm fine popping up and throwing the throwing knife or whatever. But when they turn and point a gun at you, it's like every time that happened, I ripped the thing off my face. There was a time I like almost hit the controller into the wall. It's just, it's so unsettling.
Yeah.
Even though you're in this cartoon world.
I did this virtual reality experience where it was with the Oculus Rift, and I had like, you know, they give you a gun and you walk around in this abandoned warehouse. And it was like it was a shoot 'em up with zombies. I wonder how that would have been had they been real people.
Yeah. I don't know. It's gonna bring up a lot of interesting questions and make people feel some interesting things.
Yeah. But it seems like you're excited about the potential, so... Yeah,
there's definitely a lot of good that can come from it. And it's just, it's a whole new dimension. I mean, not to be cheesy, but... Awesome. It's a new black box.
It is. I can't wait for black box on Oculus Rift, the ultimate level of frustration.
Might have talked about it.
All right, Ryan, thank you for coming on the show today. This was really awesome. Heaps of fun.
It's fun to talk to you.
Thanks for listening. And as promised, I have a bit of an update for you. There's been a lot that's happened in Ryan's life since we recorded that interview over a year ago. And I have three key updates about Black Box and Ryan's life that I want to tell you about. The first is that Black Box has had over 4 million downloads to date. They hit that milestone a little while ago, which is crazy to think of how many people you impact with this kind of game that you just happen to make. And one really fun stat that Ryan shared with me recently is that since the app's launch, there's never been a single minute where nobody was playing the game. In fact, the number of concurrent users is usually about 100 people at a time. So just thinking about that makes me panic about, you know, how much responsibility rests on the shoulders of an app developer. The second big piece of news is that a couple of months ago, Black Box was awarded an Apple Design Award at the Worldwide Developer Conference by Apple. Now, these awards are massive. It's a really big deal because they're showcasing essentially the best-in-class apps across their entire platform for the entire year. And for Black Box to have won is a huge achievement. So congratulations, Ryan. And there's no doubt in my mind that you absolutely deserved it. And the third piece of news is that a little while ago, Ryan released a bunch of new sounds in the app. He basically revamped the audio of the entire app. And part of this was installing what he describes as, quote, alternative sonic interfaces, end quote. And what this has done is made the app more accessible. And in app development language, it means accessible to an audience with some form of a disability. And in the case of Black Box, it means that blind or vision impaired people can actually play the game now. If you think about it, that's pretty amazing. This game was designed to be used with vision. It's got, you know, visual clues on the screen. And so to create an entire new interface, an audiophonic, or what he's described as a sonic interface for the game, is essentially redesigning the entire app for a different channel. And no doubt that was a lot of work. But the results are absolutely amazing because there's an entire new community of people that are blind or vision impaired that can now play the game. Ryan's received a couple of emails, and I actually read some reviews on the Black Box Facebook page of people who have vision impairments, and they are so, so happy that somebody has made a game that is tailored to them. It's kind of like a brain teaser, a way for them to work out their brain when, you know, there's not a lot of situations where they can currently do that. And I think that effort that Ryan went to actually do that really tells you a lot about his character. I mean, the total addressable market of blind or vision impaired people is probably not that large, but Ryan said it best to me when he said, "You got to remember to look through the numbers and remember that each one is a person." And finally, I asked Ryan what's next for Black Box, and he told me there's plenty of things that he's still working on. He'd like to internationalize the game so it's accessible to non-English speaking countries, but that requires a lot of, you know, translations and things like that. iPad support is another big thing on his list, and of course, he's consistently working on creating more puzzles, because he has an army of people bashing down his door asking for more puzzles all the time. But the final thing that Ryan said really resonated with me. He said, "It's still my baby." And what that really means in developer talk is that he still really loves this app. It's, you know, something that represents him as a person and his values and the fact that he's been able to make a living out of developing this app and still continue to make something that he loves and impact a huge number of people's lives is really the dream for any indie developer. And I think, you know, it's pretty rare for a lot of developers to be able to do that. So I just want to extend my personal congratulations and also thanks to Ryan for creating something so magical. Thanks for listening to Mate. If you'd like to find the show notes for this episode, head to matepodcast.com. You can follow Mate on social media, Mate Podcast on Facebook, or at Mate Podcast on Twitter. Thanks again to Ryan for coming on this episode, back when we recorded it in June 2016, and also for providing a bit of an update for us. This episode was edited by Josh Armour from ArmourPod Productions. The artwork was by Courtney Carman, and our theme music is by Nine Inch Nails. Our ad music is by Ben Sound, all used under a Creative Commons license. Like I said at the top of the show, I'm working on some really exciting things right now, so stay tuned. I'll have an episode out soon about my key outtakes from my trip to California at Podcast Movement, but in the meantime, I'm going to give you a few of the all-time best-ofs from the Mate podcast archives. This episode was made with love in Melbourne, Australia. I'm your host, Adam Jaffrey, and I will speak to you soon. Bye for now.